And in a few minutes, we're going to have a fun time going through Job 38 to 42. And I'm hoping some of you brought these sheets that I handed out last week. Several of you got them? Good. I got 50 more here in case you forgot to bring yours. As I mentioned last week, I've learned that for a class of this size, you need 300 handouts to keep things going. So you can give those available.
Raise your hand if you need one.
Okay. We'll get to that in a few minutes. I want to pick up a couple of discoveries I didn't get to last week. And some of you asked questions if I can make a few comments about the comet impactor that took place last week. Why NASA did that. It's a fairly expensive procedure to send a spaceship to a comet and blast a hole in it and try to recover stuff from that. But one of the main motivations for doing that is that the evidence we have of comets would be meteorites that hit the ground. Most meteorites that hit the ground are remnants of broken up comets. And so that's been our source of information on what comet material is made up of. And it's something you'll see in our Origins of Life book on the table over there, is that comets has been considered to be the source of prebiotic material to planet Earth. I mean, you can't get the prebiotics on the surface of the Earth because of what they call the ultraviolet oxygen paradox. If you got oxygen in the Earth's environment, that will stop prebiotic chemistry. If you don't have oxygen, then ultraviolet radiation comes pouring through, and that stops the prebiotic chemistry. And so from a naturalistic perspective, the only way you can get the prebiotics to planet Earth is if some stuff from outer space comes through the atmosphere and drops it in. And it was a lot of excitement 15, 20 years ago because they found amino acids in some meteorite fragments, particularly the Murchison meteorite and the Nakhla meteorite that hit in Australia and Egypt respectively. And they also found some amino acids in meteorites that have hit in Antarctica. But after about a decade of analysis, what they discovered is the amino acids in the Australian meteorite match the amino acid signature of Australian soil. The amino acids they found in the Nakhla meteorite in Egypt matches the amino acid signature that you find in Nile river water, and the amino acid signature they found in the Antarctic meteorites matches what you got in Antarctic meltwater. In other words, these meteorites get contaminated the moment they hit the Earth. And this is even the case with a meteorite that they found in a frozen lake in British Columbia, the Taglish Lake meteorite. And that was caused a lot of excitement because there was some homesteader up there that actually saw the meteorite fall and within days had recovered a sample. And because it fell in a frozen lake, they said, now we got a pristine sample. But after about 2 years of study, they said even the Taglish Lake meteorite is contaminated by biological decay products. Matter of fact, that study of the Taglish Lake meteorite demonstrated that the meteorite got contaminated even as it went through the Earth's atmosphere. In our atmosphere, you may recognize this, you asthma sufferers, there are amino acids in the atmosphere. And a meteorite going through the atmosphere will pick up those amino acids. And so for a long time, last several years, the story at NASA is, if we're ever going to find out what's really in a comet, we got to grab one of these meteorites before it hits the atmosphere. And of course, that's quite a job to do, to send us some little glove out there to catch a meteorite as it's coming through. And I said, that's not really practical. What we need to do is actually go to a comet, a big comet, and smash it with something and see if we can analyze the debris from the smash. And that's really what this whole NASA thing is all about. Because there was an idea at NASA, maybe we can go to a comet and actually land on the comet, dig some stuff up, bring it back to Earth. Then they chalked up how many U.S. dollars it would take to pull that off, and they said, well, let's see if we can come up with a cheaper way. And so what happened last week is the cheap way to do it. You just send a spaceship up there, detach a vehicle that will impact the thing hard enough that it will blow a small crater into the comet, and then as the debris blasts out from the collision point, then you can analyze that debris with spectrometers and other equipment. So that's the whole thing. It'll take about 18 months before they get the answer back. So don't expect it within the next few days. That's not going to happen. Although there will be some initial results that will come out in the next 60 days. But the whole point is they're looking for these prebiotic molecules, amino acids, nucleotides, and sugars. Those are the building blocks of DNA, RNA, and proteins. And incidentally, these are relatively simple molecules. But no one, no astronomer, has been able to find any of these molecules anywhere in outer space. So in that sense, we could have saved the taxpayer more money because we could say we already know that this comet stuff isn't going to have these materials in it. Why? Because comets are basically the condensed or the collapsed aftermath of dense molecular clouds. And all over our galaxy are these dense molecular clouds. You find them, like if you look through a pair of binoculars tonight, well, not tonight, real early in the morning, in the Orion Nebula, you will see a dense molecular cloud. There are dense molecular clouds in Sagittarius that you can also see with a pair of binoculars, the Lagoon Nebula, for example. That's one of the things we want to look at in our star party. These dense molecular clouds will have little pockets where they collapse and they make comets. And the comets are considered to be the building blocks of planets. And so, but, you know, already astronomers have been looking at these molecular clouds and noted that they've been unsuccessful in finding any amino acids, nucleotides, or sugars that are relevant to the origin of life. They have found glycoaldehydes, but these are just three carbon sugars, and they're useless for origin of life chemistry. What you need is the 5 and 6 carbon sugars, and those they've not found. And if you've been following our Today's New Reasons to Believe at our reasons.org website, you'll notice in the last 6 months astronomers withdrew the 4-year-old claim. 4 years ago, they claimed to have found the simplest amino acid, glycine, in one of these dense molecular clouds. But in the Astrophysical Journal in February, that claim was withdrawn because they said we had misidentified the spectral lines. And now with proper identification, they realized they were wrong on saying they had found glycine. Likewise, pyrimidine, that's the simplest of the nucleotides, that claim has also been withdrawn. So, you know, in that sense, we know that stuff's not there. Well, the reason, I mean, astronomers have worked out the physics and the chemistry of what it would take to form these amino acids, and glycine is the easiest thing to make. The nucleotides are a little bit harder, but not impossible to make. The environment in these dense molecular clouds is such that you should be able to make small amounts. The reason why we're not finding any is because these dense molecular clouds also have a radiation environment that destroys the stuff that you make. So I do believe that amino acids and nucleotides, not the complex ones, just the simple ones. The complex ones are another matter. But the simplest of the amino acids and the nucleotides should be manufactured in these sites. The problem is they're being destroyed at the same rate they're being manufactured. And so if they do detect them, they'll probably be at parts per billion. Not the parts per million that we've been finding in the meteorites that have, that they've recovered from the Earth. So yeah, and by the way, this craft does have a sensitivity to pick stuff up at as low as one part per billion. So it wouldn't surprise me if they do find it at a few parts per billion, but that's not going to help them any in terms of trying to solve origin of life from a naturalistic perspective. You need concentrations of parts per thousand, not parts per billion. And so if they find it at parts per billion or less, then that simply confirms that the stuff is being destroyed as rapidly as it's being made, which is what we would expect. Yes. Why there's such a bright light? Well, you're hitting the thing with a piece of metal that's moving at a high velocity relative to the comet. So, yeah, that's going to... Right. Well, comets are loaded with volatiles. And so if you hit a comet with an object at sufficient speed, you're going to blast off all these volatile gases, And that's why comets are bright to see in the sky. Comets are really small objects. This is one of the biggest comets they're going after, but typically they're just hundreds of feet across. The bigger ones are a kilometer or so across. But when they pass by the sun, so much of the gases get to volatilize off that it shines as bright as anything in the sky. That when was it? Back in the late 1980s, there was a comet that competed with the moon in terms of size, not in brightness, but in terms of size. And I don't think it was Hale-Bopp. There was another one that was even brighter. Hale-Bopp was pretty spectacular. But, you know, there was one that was the size of the moon in terms of angular size, and it was brighter than the planet Jupiter. So, and yet very little stuff was generating that. Well, that's one reason why they did this experiment. They knew they didn't even have to hit it very hard to get enough of a blast of gases off it that they could analyze with spectroscopes. But that's really what the strategy is all about. But there was some talk that you might be able to see it through amateur telescopes. That proved not to be the case. There were very large telescopes that were able to see it from the ground. Well, to put that in perspective, how many of you ever seen that meteor crater in Arizona? Yeah, you just off of Highway 10 as you go by there. And, you know, that thing's almost a mile in diameter and 350 feet deep, yet that was blasted off by a rock no bigger than 100 feet across. So, you know, relatively small rock caused all that damage, but the reason why, it was moving at a high velocity. And that's why this little tiny spaceship with its copper jacket was able to do so much damage. It was moving at a high velocity relative to the comet. Remember your high school physics class or junior high physics? That the amount of energy you get from the collision goes up with the square of the velocity, where it's just simply proportional to the mass. So if you want to do a lot of damage, you want to move fast. It's not the weight, it's the velocity you're moving that's going to have the biggest impact. Okay, any more questions? Yes. Well, at this point, that's a consensus. I mean, that's not definitive, but they said the fact that every meteorite that they found amino acids in, it matches the signature of biological material in the vicinity of the crash. And the fact that it's at parts per million or less, that's what you'd expect. In other words, people have done calculations saying, what's the minimal contamination you will get? Well, it's right at the minimal level from the biological material in the area. So, and likewise, there was some thought that they had found nucleotides in the Murchison meteorite. That's the biggest meteorite that's been recovered and analyzed. It's about 1,500 pounds. And there it was parts per billion, but that again is right where you'd expect for contamination. So, and as I've mentioned here, they've now withdrawn all claims that they found any in interstellar clouds. Yes. You're going to have to get our Journey Toward Creation DVD. That was an old idea, but the problem was they could not figure out a way an object could hit the Earth and break off a piece that could become the Moon. The dynamics simply doesn't work. But they have come up with a scenario that does work, and works so well that all astronomers are convinced this is the way the Moon did form. Namely, that a Mars-sized planet collided with the Earth, not head-on, not glancing, at a 45-degree angle at low velocity. So, but the fact that it hit at low velocity means that the collider was absorbed into the Earth, but there would have been a debris cloud of fine, light material that would have been blasted away from the Earth's gravity, and this fine dust debris cloud around the Earth coalesced and formed the Moon. But if you want to see a beautiful computer animation of that whole scenario, we have it in the Journey Toward Creation DVD. And it's one of the strongest arguments we have for fine-tuning, because advanced life would be impossible on planet Earth unless the Earth was orbited by a gigantic single moon of the properties that the moon has. And you can't get that moon to form unless you've got an object of almost exactly the mass of Mars hitting at just that angle, at just that velocity, at just that time. If the timing is off, the mass is off, the angle is off, the velocity is off, you won't get the moon forming in the way it must form for advanced flight to be possible. So, yeah, it's a real neat deal. Yeah. Okay. That won't do anything. I mean, the dynamics of, say, the Earth's orbit about the sun, the most important object is the sun. The next most important object is the moon, and then Jupiter. That comet is so way down the line, it doesn't matter. So, and then this object hitting the comet is even less of a factor. But the problem with astrology is they don't think about gravity. What they're thinking about is just the object itself. And so, for example, in astrology, there's this myth that where the planets are at the time you're born determines your personality for the rest of your life. Because the position of the planets has all these dramatic effects on this baby that's being born. Well, in terms of the actual physics, you should be much more concerned about the obstetrician than any possible orientation of the planets. A typical obstetrician will exert at least 6 times the gravitational pull on the baby as any possible combination of planets or comets. So, and then where the father is in the room is a big factor too. So, you might want to have your husband gain weight or lose weight or position himself in a particular part of the room if indeed you actually believe this astrology has anything. But I think, as I mentioned last week, you really shouldn't be putting any credence in astrology anyway. Whatever sign you're in, you're not in that sign. Astrologers don't correct for precession. And so you're 1 or 2 signs away from where they tell you you are. And they don't even include all the signs in the zodiac. They only include 12. And there are 13 or 14 constellations in the zodiac, depending on where you are in the precession sequence. So it's not science. If you want to see something on that, it's on our website. It's called Astrology, Science, or What. It's only 3 pages long. It's downloadable. And she's not going to get her $300 million. So she probably got publicity that may be worth that much, but hopefully that doesn't get to court. All right. The discovery I wanted to share with you last week, I never got to. It's a brand new time dilation test for cosmic expansion. This is published in the latest issue of the Astrophysical Journal Letters. And it's something I described in this book, A Matter of Days, that time dilation is a wonderful way to test different models for the expansion of the universe. And what you have here are atheists who are coming up with models where the universe does not expand in any significant way. There's a model called the quasi-steady-state theory. It's kind of a new version of the steady-state model. And it's all based on the idea that these distant quasars are ejected from giant galaxies rather than being galaxies in themselves with big black holes at the center. And so they're impacted by this time dilation test. Standard cosmology is impacted. Old Earth creationism is impacted. Young Earth creationists claim that we're not getting time dilation, we're getting time compression. And so this is a wonderful way to put this to the test. And you say, what on earth is time dilation? Okay, one equation that virtually every audience is familiar with is E equals mc squared. And E equals mc squared was derived by Albert Einstein based on the observation that we have time dilation. And you say, great, what's that all about? Well, what that's all about is the statement that if you've got 2 clocks, one clock will run at a different rate relative to the other clock depending on the velocity of one clock relative to clock A. Now, I wouldn't worry about your watches and how fast you walk, because the amount of time slowing down depends on the square root. Let me, I should write this on the blackboard so that you can all see it. Yeah, it's pretty close to 1. Unless your velocity is really large compared to the velocity of light. But in an expanding universe model, where you've got the universe continuously expanding from a creation event about 14 billion years ago, Once a few billion years goes by, that means the most distant objects are moving at, say, half or even three-quarters of the velocity of light relative to the observer here on planet Earth. And so time dilation should be significant, which means that if you're looking at a very distant galaxy, clocks in that galaxy should be running anywhere from 10 to 50% slower than they do here on Earth. Now, as explained here in this book, A Matter of Days, if you're coming at it from a young Earth creationist perspective, they're trying to explain how light in distant galaxies gets here to planet Earth in less than 10,000 years. And so what they're hypothesizing is that there's gravitational time compression. Not time expansion, but time compression. And so a young Earth model would predict that distant clocks will run about a million times faster than they do here on Earth. An old Earth creationist model would predict that they would run like 10 to 40% slower than they do here on Earth, depending on the distance. The greater the distance, the greater the velocity, therefore the greater the time dilation effect. Whereas these quasi-steady-state people are predicting there'll be no compression or dilation at all. So they're predicting that distant clocks will be running at exactly the same rate they do here on Earth. Young Earthers, that they'll run a million times faster. Old Earth creationists, that they'll run like 10 to 40% slower. And it's such that if you know the velocity of the object, you can predict exactly what that time dilation factor should be to a few places a decimal. Now, as I mentioned in this book, A Matter of Days, you know, it's an elegant technique, but where it's difficult to apply is that you have to look at very distant objects to get enough velocity to make a difference in the clock. I mean, it won't do to go to the Andromeda Galaxy. The Andromeda Galaxy is so close that its velocity relative to us isn't enough to make any difference. It's going to measure to be zero. So you really got to get a good distance away. You literally got to be looking billions of light years away before you get a velocity in an old Earth creationist model is large enough that you're going to see anything. Well, the problem with doing that is when you get that far away, your measuring accuracy isn't that great. And so what I mentioned in this book is that they were able to demonstrate this, make a test, by using statistical methods. Saying, okay, we have large error bars, so what we're going to do, instead of looking at one galaxy, we'll look at hundreds of galaxies. Excuse me. And so they would look at, say, 100 different galaxies and look at supernova explosions in those galaxies. Supernova are great clocks to look for in distant galaxies. Why? Because when a star goes supernova, it shines with light equivalent to 100 billion normal stars, which means you're going to be able to see it a really long ways away. But it doesn't shine that brightly for very long, only a few months. And so your supernova will very rapidly go up to maximum brightness. By rapidly, I mean in about 40 days. It goes from normal brightness to maximum brightness in 40 days, and then it takes about 7 months to drop back down to its normal brightness. And so you got about 8 months in which a supernova goes through its light curve. Well, in a galaxy that's moving at a high velocity relative to us, we'd say it should take 9, 10, 11, or 12 months, whereas the young Earth creationist model would say would take a few seconds. So, you know, you can look at this and see what it is. And the statistics was pretty decent. You know, with 100 supernova and 100 different galaxies, you could definitely see that the more distant the galaxy, the longer it took to go through its whole light curve phase. And they were also able to do that with gamma ray bursts. Now, these are only a few seconds long, gamma ray bursts. But they know it, but they're also extremely bright, so you can see them at billions of light years away and in X-ray wavelengths. And here they had about 300 gamma ray bursts as opposed to just 100 supernova, and they also, through their statistics, were able to show the more distant the gamma ray bursts, the longer it would take to go through its whole burst cycle. But missing in all this was accurate measurements on a single supernova or gamma ray bursts in one galaxy. And that's where this team came through. And actually what they were dealing with is an attempt by atheists to come up with an explanation for the statistical data that was published about 2 years ago from a quasi-steady-state model. And what they're basically saying is, well, there's this, you know, supernova make a lot of nickel when they explode. It's one of the most abundant elements that supernova make. And they were hypothesizing that the production of nickel would vary over the age of the universe. And therefore, they were thinking they could actually explain away this expansion of the universe effect. So what this team did is they said, okay, we need to really nail this down in a way that no one can argue with. And it's basically what they pulled off. And so they did a lot of work on supernova and galaxies that are nearby. And what they did is they created a catalog of spectral features at different points in the cycle of the supernova's existence, when it's becoming brighter and then when it's becoming dimmer. And they were looking for particular spectral features of change all the way through, and created this rather massive catalog, which basically gave them a standard which by they could look at a single supernova in a distant galaxy and measure, relative to the standard catalog, how quickly this supernova would begin to express the different spectral features. Now, the advantage of this is that the spectral features will depend on many different elements. That won't be just nickel. You'll have carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, iron, all kinds of these spectral lines will be displayed, and you're basically measuring when different spectral features become prominent, at which point relative to the maximum brightness of the supernova eruption. And by this means, they were able to determine that this one particular supernova in a galaxy at a redshift of 0.361 had exactly the spectral changes, the rate of spectral change you'd expect in a universe that's continuously expanding for 14 billion years. So they said this closes the door on all quasi-steady-state models. We now know the universe is not infinitely old. And we also know that it's not less than 10,000 years old. So, and also shows that we live in a universe that indeed continuously expands from the creation event. And this is all based on just one supernova and one galaxy. Now, of course, they concluded their paper by saying this is a technique that could be employed in any distant galaxy. Basically, what the discovery is all about is here's a brand new technique that's going to enable us to come up with a precision test for expanding universe models. And what they're really after is this. Within old Earth creationism, the idea that the universe was created 14 billion years ago and continuously expands from that creation event, there's lots of subcategories. Models of the universe where we have a greater expression of expansion, slightly greater expression at about a 1 or 2% level early in the history of the universe. There's speculation that maybe dark energy is slightly stronger or more weakly expressed in the first 8 billion years of the history of the universe, and they're saying this technique is going to nail down those fine details under the umbrella of a universe that continuously expands for 14 billion years. But the bottom line is this. What was the first person to write about a continuously expanding universe? If you ask most people, they'd say Albert Einstein. But the truth is, it's not Albert Einstein. It's Job. It's Zechariah. It's Jeremiah. It's Isaiah, where you know the Bible does explicitly state that we have a universe that begins at a finite time ago and continuously expands from that point of beginning. So coming up with this elegant proof is a great way to show that, hey, the Bible is thousands of years ahead of the scientists in describing what kind of universe we live in. It's also thousands of years ahead of the scientists in predicting that in the expansion of the universe, we would see one of the more dramatic fingerprints of God's creative activity. Job chapter 9, God alone expands the universe. Well, so far, because, you know, this has been in this book now for nearly a year, and you know, we had a chance to talk about this. I spoke on it in a group of two younger creationist leaders last March. And, you know, that was about 10 to 15 minutes of my hour-long presentation. During the Q&A time, they didn't ask a single question on it. It's like they pretended I said nothing about it. But the old Earth creationists picked up on it right away, that this really is a very elegant and definitive test that shows us how long the universe has been expanding. But, you know, in terms of this paper in the Astrophysical Journal, they don't care two bits about the young Earth creationists. Their concern is in dealing with the atheists who are trying to push a universe that expands for infinite time or doesn't expand at all. And their whole point is, just with this one measurement, we can close the door on that model. And if you're not convinced, let's measure a few more of these galaxies, because this is a relatively easy method to do. You know, their main contribution is creating this standard catalog of spectral changes in supernova up close. With that catalog, we now have a very powerful tool for measuring in detail the expansion rates of the universe. Okay, I was going to get to another discovery. I'm going to save for next week because, hey, we got to get some time in on this thing here. So what I want you to do, we got about a half hour left, and I discussed this last week, that one of the big debates over Job 38 through to 42 is which parts of these five chapters of Job do we take literally and which parts do we take as being allegory or metaphor. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the fine details. You know, what we see in Job 38 to 42, you see simile, you see metaphor, you see allegory. And what's the difference? A simile is a comparison. You know, this is like this, or this is as this. And you see a lot of that in the Job 40 and 41. A metaphor is not a comparison, it's a word picture. A good example is what Jesus said in the Gospels, "I am the door." He didn't mean that he was a literal door. He was giving us a word picture of what his ministry was all about. And an allegory is simply a fairly lengthy development of a word picture. And good examples of that you find in the book of Ezekiel, which literally run for several chapters, where Ezekiel develops this word picture for the benefit of the audience. And as you see here in the little handout I've given out, the fact that a passage is metaphorical or allegorical does not make it any less true. There are very important reasons why the Bible uses metaphor and allegory and simile in different passages. It's basically to help the audience through something that's difficult to understand or where the audience is resistant in receiving the teaching. And again, you see this in the Gospels, where you would note that Jesus would speak plainly to his disciples. Why? Because his disciples were not resistant to his message. And so he spoke to them without parable or metaphor. But to the audiences that were resistant, particularly the scribes and the Pharisees, he used parables to communicate to them, because he recognized that if he spoke plainly or literally to them, they, because of their pride and because of the spiritual state they were in, they would not be able to receive it. And again, you know, parents do this in ministering to their children. You spot your places where your children are in a state of rebellion, and you say, well, if I tell it to them straight, they're not going to hear it. Let me tell them a story. You get that example with King David. Remember when he was confronted by his prophet, and the prophet did not speak to him literally. He says, I want to tell you a story about a farmer and his lamb. And he was done with the story. He noted that King David got very emotionally aroused about the story, and he says, you are the man. This is a story about you. And David was able to repent. But if you had confronted him literally, that probably wouldn't have happened. So anyway, you can take a look at this. But what I want you to do right now is break up into groups of four. So find three people in your vicinity. And what I want you to do is start. I was going to have you start with chapter 34, but I think that's a little more daunting. Let's just start with chapter 38. And as I mentioned last week, the context is this. We've got young Earth creationists and others, reconstructionists, fall into this camp too, where they look at Job 38 and 39 and see that as being completely metaphorical or allegorical or figurative, And yet when they look at Job 40 and 41, they see that as being literal stuff. Whereas old earth creationists tend to take the opposite view. They look at Job 38 and 39 as being predominantly literal, and Job 40 to 41 as being predominantly metaphorical. Now, what makes this difficult is you will find stuff in Job 38 and 39, in my opinion as an old earth creationist, that is metaphorical. But the whole point is predominantly. One side sees two chapters as being predominantly one way, the other side sees it as the opposite. So in other words, if we can find some way to look at these texts and figure out what is metaphorical and what is not metaphorical, what should be taken literally, maybe this could be a means whereby we can bring about significant resolution in creation disputes within the body of Christ. So, how about if we spend 20 minutes in our groups, and that'll give us 10 minutes to report back at least some of our initial findings. My guess is it's going to take more than one class time to do this. We'll probably have to spend some time next week doing this too, but let me give you 20 minutes. And I'll give you a one-minute warning before that time's up. That does not mean that the whole passage, however, should be taken as metaphorical. And there is a literal message in the metaphor. So I want various ones of you just to share what you've discovered. I think most of you focused on Job 38, right? Okay. So why don't you just share with us some... How about each group, let's just share one metaphor that you found, or simile, or allegory, but explain, I mean, the whole point is, if you just see a few metaphors in a text, that does not mean we have no idea what the text is communicating, or that we can't use this to reflect on any other passage of Scripture. Just like when Jesus said, I am the door, okay. How are we to put that in the context of the literal contents? Contents is actually there. Okay, can someone take an example? And what's the personification focusing on? Which person? Yeah, it's God that's speaking here. This isn't Job. This is God speaking. And so when God is speaking and trying to communicate to us what he has done, he often uses anthropomorphisms. So we'll get the point. But I think as you're pointing out, that doesn't mean that there isn't some actual literal message in all this. God is trying to describe it in language that we'll understand kind of what he was doing. Anybody else discuss that passage? I mean, that's a good one. By the way, these verses, 8 through 11, are a source of tremendous dispute amongst creationists as to what they mean. So focusing on these, I think, is critical. And the reason why I think it is such a disputed passage, no doubt metaphors are in the text. But does that mean that this has nothing to do with creation theology? I don't think so. It's God trying to describe how he created in language that we would understand. Yes. Okay. Well, this particular text was actually a source of probably three-quarters of the debate I had with the young earth creationist astronomer Jason Lyle. And the point I was making is that this reflects what we see in Genesis 1, when God had enshrouded the primordial earth and a cloud layer was opaque to light. He insisted that was not the case at all. This was all metaphor, it was allegory, it was figurative, and had nothing to do with anything that pertained to creation. But he was an astronomer. I mean, Jason Lyle was. But the whole point is, if you're going to say it's got nothing to do with creation, what does it have to do with? And I think that's a good way to look at metaphor and word picture, is if you're going to say it doesn't mean that, well then what does it mean? Otherwise you can explain away anything. His response was that Job 38 had nothing to do with creation theology. It was purely metaphorical, purely figurative. He never said. It's Bible filler. There you go. Well, I mean, we're joking, but That's the whole point, is that, you know, the Bible is filled with metaphor. This text is filled with a lot of metaphors. It's just one. And I noted about 12 metaphors in Job 38. On the other hand, I don't see any of those metaphors as taking away from creation theology. They're adding to it. So, and it's okay to say this is metaphorical or figurative, but then you need to come up with something that explains, okay, what is the figure of speech? Why is this figure of speech being used? What is the intent? And that's kind of what I've got here in my little list here. If you're going to say that something is metaphorical, then it's incumbent upon you to look at the text and say, okay, what is the metaphor? What is it communicating? And why is a metaphor being used here? I mean, at what point would these five men be struggling to understand what God is communicating here? In that sense, I think there's some merit for saying this is difficult creation theology God's trying to get across to these five individuals. Right. Well, I think you're giving us a context for why the metaphor. You know, if you look at what's been going on before chapter 38, it's these men debating creation theology. And God steps in and says, you guys aren't as smart as you think you are. You don't know as much about this. And you're calling into question things that I've done in creation when you have no basis for doing that. You know, in that particular context helps us understand why he's asking the questions he's asking. Why he's putting these people in the place they deserve to be put in. And so in that sense, we're seeing a point of resistance, which is one of the things we noted here. The Bible will use metaphor and figures of speech where there's points of resistance with the audience. So the fact that we see here in the text that the Lord is actually addressing those points of resistance does give us some basis for the metaphor. You made an excellent point, too. Is that it's very difficult to say that Job 38 has got nothing to do with creation when you read on down the text and you say, well, when it's talking about snow and rain, that sounds like physical creation. There are certain statements here in the text where it's extremely difficult to say this has got nothing to do with creation. And if you find at least a few, then that should give you some pause to go back and say, okay, maybe there's stuff in the rest of Job 38 that also pertains to physical creation. If I got one example, I need to look at the others. And then finally, you made an excellent point, and this came up in my debate, is that Job 38 is not ordered in the sequence that we see in Genesis 1. Therefore, it's got nothing to do with creation. That's kind of the argument I heard. But that, I think, is kind of our anthropomorphism. We're English readers. And in the English culture, we like sequences. We like things nicely ordered and structured. Is that true for ancient Hebrews? I mean, as you look at throughout Scripture, they seem to have a different culture or cultural perspective in looking at things than we do. So the mere fact that it's not sequenced exactly as Genesis 1, does that make it any less credible as scientific content or literal? So, great point. Thanks. Well, how about this? Do we see any merit in what you're saying in a sense, okay, it's not following a strict sequence that's chronologically valid with respect to the established record of nature like Genesis 1 does? Why? Why is this not using a sequence, and why is Genesis 1 using a sequence if indeed this is meant to reflect on creation? I want us to hold that question to next week because we're about 5 minutes over time, out of time. So we'll pray, and you guys could just remember to pick up on that question next week, because I think that's an excellent starting point. Father in heaven, we thank you for our time in this text. We thank you for this time in which we live, in which so many exciting discoveries are taking place that allow us to put to the test our Christian faith and give us new tools to persuade people that you're out there, that you care for them and love them and have a great plan for their life. Lord, empower us in our personal witness this week as we meet our friends and associates at the work. Give us opportunities to encourage them to receive of your light. And Father, I pray you would give us more light as we examine these texts. Lord, thank you for having this book written for our benefit.